So some of the people most involved in trying to stop the current occupation of Iraq are members of military families, many of them here in Charlottesville and in the surrounding areas. And there's a mom whose son has done two tours of Iraq as a Marine, who now lives in Washington, D.C., full-time, lobbying against the occupation. And many of you who watch things on the internet or CNN, MSNBC may recall several weeks back, many weeks back now, Congressman David Obey screaming at the mother of a Marine in the hallways in Congress because she asked him to end the war, and saying that she didn't understand, and these idiot liberals need to learn the way Congress works, and the Democrats don't really have the power to end the war, and these stupid liberals just think so. And, you know, when you travel the halls of Congress encountering these people and bring a video camera, you catch their real thinking and their real feelings on tape, and then you send it to the television networks, and it helps expose where the conflicts are and where we need to move forward. And there's also a mother of a Marine who was recently charged in Washington, D.C., and faces now $20,000 and 6 months in jail for putting up an anti-war poster in Washington, D.C. This is where freedom of speech is now in this country. And, of course, in all of these stories, I'm talking about Tina Richards, and she's here to say a few words this evening.
Well, I have to say, it's really nice to be out of Washington, D.C. for this brief weekend. it gets really hectic up there, and Capitol Hill doesn't seem to have a lot of real faces there. And part of what I try to do is bring home the real pain, the suffering that the military families are going through, that the military is going through. And I actually had asked David Obey about if he had read my son's poem, and I got back a lot of flack, like, you know, what's this crazy lady bothering a congressman about a poem? And so actually I wanted to share that poem tonight and bring you some of my son's words. After his second tour, he was facing a third deployment to Iraq. He's 80% disabled from his two tours in Iraq. And so despite traumatic brain injury, despite post-traumatic stress disorder, despite the fact he was hit with a mortar and has neck, back problems, had a cannon on his knee, that didn't matter because he could still pull a trigger. He could still give orders, and they needed him back in Iraq. And that's where our military is at now. They don't care. There has not been any level of caring there for the soldiers, for the Marines, and they're driving them to the highest suicide rate that we have ever seen in any war with these repeated deployments. This has been such a turning time for me to where I've sold my house, I've given up everything, and now, you know, live in D.C. to fight this fight. And anybody who wants to join me, you're more than welcome. Here's some words from my son. It's called Why I Fight for Peace, which actually Lynn Woolsey read this into the Congressional Record, so you can find it in the Congressional Record now. Because I can't forget, no matter how hard I try, they told us we were taking out advancing Iraqi forces. But when we went to check out the bodies, they were nothing but women and children, desperately fleeing their homes because they wanted to get out of the city before we attacked in the morning. Because my little brother, who is my job to protect, decided to join the National Guard to get some money for college, and they promised he wouldn't go to Iraq. Instead, 3 months after enlisting, he was sent to Iraq for 1 year. Since he's been home for the last 6 months, he refuses to talk to anyone. He lives by himself. The only person he associates with is a friend of his, the one other man out of his squad of 13 men who made it home alive. He called me a few weeks ago for the first time and told me he's having nightmares. I asked what they were about, and he said they're about picking up the pieces of his fellow soldiers after a car bomb hit them. Because every single one of the Marines I served with, the really brave warriors, even when some friends and people they looked up to got killed and lost an arm or a leg, they wouldn't cry. They just kept fighting. They completed their mission. Every one of them I've spoken to since we got home has broken down crying in front of me, saying all they can do since they got back is bounce from job to job, drink and do drugs, and contemplate suicide to end the pain. Because I'm tired of drinking, bouncing from job to job, and contemplating suicide to end the pain. Because every time I see a child, I think of the thousands I have slaughtered. Because every time I see a young soldier, I think of the thousands Bush has slaughtered. Because every time I look in the mirror, I see a casualty of war. Because I have a lot of lives I have to make up for, the lives I have taken. And because it's right, that's why I fight. Because of soldiers with wounds you can't see. And every single one of you that go out and fight to defend this Constitution, when you're here defending the Constitution, that means like putting up a poster for the freedom of speech, you truly are a warrior for peace also. And every single one of you are such an important aspect to this movement and to saving our Constitution and to saving soldiers and Marines like my son. Thank you.
Tina has an organization called Grassroots for America. Grassroots America for Us is the website, correct? So you can find it online, Grassroots America. We have two speakers to hear from still this evening who are both among the best voices we have in the media and the best critics we have of the media. Norman Solomon is here from San Francisco. His columns are widely published, and they critique the media with an emphasis on the media's unflagging support for war. And Norman was on C-SPAN today discussing one of his new books. He was on Democracy Now! On Wednesday. Made Love, Got War is one of his recent books, which he can sign a copy of out back, and it's part biography, part autobiography, part history of the peace movement. It's an incredibly valuable book. War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death, is also an incredibly powerful book, and it's a film that's been shown at two different locations in Charlottesville. Another book of Norman's is Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, which has been published in six languages. One of Norman's many books, The Habits of Highly Deceptive Media, won the George Orwell Award for Distinguished Contribution to Honesty and Clarity in Public Language, which sounds like an award designed for Norman Solomon. Norman is also the founder of the Institute for Public Accuracy, which works very hard and very effectively to get voices that are usually shut out into the media, the independent media, the progressive media, and the so-called mainstream corporate media. It's an incredibly valuable organization that has been going now for many years. It's a great privilege for us to have Norman Solomon here this evening. Please give him a round of applause.
Thanks very much. David Swanson is one of the great organizers in the United States, and yet I know that even one great organizer can't pull together an event such as this, so I want to thank not only David, but everybody who is involved in making it possible for us to gather here this evening. I just realized a few minutes ago when Tina read the poem that she shared with us where I had heard it before. It was just hours, maybe minutes, after the Congress had voted at the urging of many, including some who felt they were urging an anti-war vote, for the supplemental appropriation for war in Iraq. I believe it was, I want to say, March. I was watching C-SPAN, and my Congresswoman, who truly represents me, and there are few in Congress I could say that about, Lynn Woolsey, stood in the well of the House, as she had done well over 100 times before then, and denounced the war. She had voted against the appropriations under any guise, a vote for war. And she read that poem, and the poem was, well, you heard it, so I don't need to say anything more about it. But after the poem was finished, Lynn Woolsey was admonished by the chair of the House of Representatives, who said that the member is reminded that personal references are not to be allowed in the House. Because the poem had referred to Bush, and Bush as someone who ordered the slaughter, and that was breaking the rules. Surely we need more people in public life willing to break those kind of rules, because war thrives on abstraction. President Bush, all war makers from afar depend on the fuzzy image, the rhetoric, the glorified individuals who are never treated as real individuals. At medium distance for the photo ops, not far away enough to be out of the frame, not close enough to see the real human being suffering, even a killer suffering after coming home. The Vietnam War, the Iraq War, we've been told for years now that Iraq is not Vietnam, and I think any competent geographer would agree. But the United States is the United States, a warfare state for decade after decade that means so much as a warfare state in respects that have nothing to do with the country where the war is waged. It's about our own political economy, our culture, our mass media. If you go back and you look at Norman Mailer's book, came out in the late 1960s, called Why Are We in Vietnam? The word Vietnam doesn't appear until the last page. Our own political economy is such that we're encouraged to live what I've come to think of as the culture of hoax. And in working on my most recent book, I went back and tried to understand the progression, the regression, the steps that we've lived through in our society. You know, I used to think that half a century was a very long time, and as the years have gone by, half a century is starting to seem shorter and shorter. I went back and looked at the 1950s, and really 50 years ago, just the other day, the 50th anniversary of the launch of Sputnik. And the response to Sputnik and what that whole era meant, the Soviet satellite being launched, was destructive of the United States, but not in the way that it was feared at the time. The danger that we succumbed to was not that we would stay behind in the arms race, which was called the space race. The danger was exactly what happened, that we would, as a society, succumb to what Martin Luther King Jr. in 1967 described as a phenomenon of guided missiles and misguided men in power. And he said, when moral power is less than technological power, then the results are, as he put it, that we have a society where year after year we spend more on military defense than on programs of social uplift. We then end up what he described as spiritual death. He was describing it in 1967. We've had four decades since. When I went back and tried to understand the culture of the 50s, which, for better and worse, I grew up in, of course, I had to think about television and the sort of the cultural messages that we were getting, which were part of the overall political and media messaging. And there was one very popular TV show, perhaps none more influential for the entire what was called baby boom generation. Not a very subtle name, Father Knows Best. And children could be excused if they often wondered why the family that they experienced on the near side of the TV screen was in some respects so deficient. Because it was a lovely family, Father Knows Best. Dad was a little quirky and certainly affectionate. Same with Mom. The kids had problems, but ultimately things were pretty much endearing and hunky-dory. Well, 17 years after that long-running TV show had the shooting stop, the guy who played Bud, you know, the only son on the program, Billy Gray, spoke up, and this is what he said. I brought here a quote. He was talking about the Father Knows Best program. He said, "I'm ashamed I had any part of it. People felt warmly about the show, and that show did everybody a disservice. I felt that the show purported to be real life, and it wasn't. I regret it was ever presented as a model to live by. I think we are all well motivated, but what we did was run a hoax. We weren't trying to, but that is what it was, just a hoax. And when you look at the not only the cultural icons, but the political messages, the financial priorities, the way in which we're encouraged to accept passively the decisions made from on high, the culture of hoax is pervasive, or if you will, it's concentric from the individual life, the workplace, the cultural milieu that we're encouraged to accept, to the military expenditures, now $2 billion a day under the misnomer of the Defense Department. I'm not against defense spending, I'm against military spending. And we've been encouraged, and this is true of peace groups as well, to say, well, our defense spending is too high. No, our military spending is too high. And the net effect of this messaging is to have us be accepting when we have the prerogative, which we occasionally exercise, to put our sticks in the spokes of the wheel of the war machinery. When I look back and I see the trajectory of the last several decades of the warfare state, I think about how the baby boom generation was really in an extraordinary role for the first time in human history, a generation that was fully expendable. An era that celebrated the push-button world, but we lived and were the first generation to grow up in a push-the-button world where we would literally, quite possibly, all collectively experience invisibility at the same moment. And those who had designed the weapons of mass destruction from the Manhattan Project on, who were lauded by one president after another, and every president has lauded the bomb makers and bomb deployers and those who are ready with the finger on the nuclear trigger, all of that was considered to be an index of our advance after Sputnik. For all the talk about how the Bush administration is anti-science, and there's kind of a liberal response that we have faith in science, that's what distinguishes us from the right wing, right? We believe in science. And yet, is there any more lauded or advanced manifestation of science than the weapons lab that I visited a year ago, the Los Alamos Nuclear Laboratory? There is no disagreement on either side of the aisle in Congress about science when it comes to nuclear. Have you ever heard of somebody in Congress standing up and saying, you know, I think that nuclear weapons are anti-science? We hear it now about global warming because activists have been raising this for so long. They say, well, of course, it's destructive of the planet. You know, and some people are denying that all these greenhouse gases and so forth and the emitters, what's emitted from the automobiles and all the rest of it, they're in denial. What we need is science. We need to end this anti-science censorship and messaging so we can understand really what is at stake. Let the science speak. Global warming is a threat to the planet. And of course it is. We're the voices that say that we need to stand up for science and recognize what nuclear weapons mean. Every scientist who isn't hallucinating understands what nuclear weapons mean for the fate of the planet, for the fate of humanity. And yet there's no debate in the Congress because the warfare state is so deep. Vote those nuclear weapons appropriations. There is a contest ongoing now between the two weapons labs, Livermore and Los Alamos, to design what is euphemized as the reliable replacement warhead. And Livermore won the latest competition, but don't worry, there's going to be another contest, so Los Alamos has a chance. Design those warheads. 25 years ago, I was doing a story for Pacific News Service about an explosive in the Poseidon nuclear warheads that were deployed on the submarines. And this was 1981, and the story ended up running in the San Francisco Examiner and the Toronto Star, and, you know, like most stories that challenged the warfare state, disappeared within a matter of hours. You know, the half-life was about 30 minutes, I think, of that story. And when I was wrapping it up, you know, the long and short of it is that this chemical called LX09 had blown up three workers in Amarillo, Texas, when it was dropped a few inches from the ground. Just totally, it was an unstable conventional explosive. And it had been put in hundreds of nuclear warheads, which then meant that they could easily be, with an accident such as had happened with other missiles at Holy Loch in Scotland or Charleston in the U.S. or elsewhere, could mean it what we now know as a dirty bomb, right? Could spread plutonium to a populated area. So I wrote up the story and I called the Pentagon. And then was about to go to press one morning, I got a call from a general who I'd interviewed at the Department of Defense, uppercase Department of Defense. And he said, "Mr. Solomon, I wanted to reach you before you send the story out because I want to really clarify a very important point. Every single one of those Poseidon nuclear warheads that is currently deployed, if it is fired, it will function as designed." This is what he was worried about, that nobody should think that these nuclear warheads wouldn't go off absolutely as designed if the order were given. That's the kind of political culture that we live in, and we're encouraged not to ask questions. It's, of course, the same kind of political culture that has brought us the war on Iraq, the same one bringing us now entering its seventh year, war in Afghanistan, the same one, of course, pushing now for an attack on Iran. When I tried to kind of take a longer view or an overview perspective, I found an extraordinary book that is almost impossible to get one's hands on. It was written in the mid-late 1960s. It's called Bomb Culture, and I'd like to share a little bit from it with you. It was written by Jeff Nuttall, who was an activist, a musician, a painter, an editor, somebody part of the Ban the Bomb movement in Britain in the early 60s and in the 50s. And this is what he said about the rebellion at the time, from Prague to London to Chicago, 1968. "What has happened is that the pressure of restrictions preceding nuclear suicide has precipitated a biological reflex compelling the leftist element in the young middle class to join with the delinquent element in the young working class for the reaffirmation of life by orgy and violence. What is happening is an evolutionary convulsion rather than a reformation. Young people are not correcting society. They are regurgitating it." And growing up in a bomb culture, who could criticize that? He reflected on that division, which is part of the wallpaper, so we rarely talk about it. Maybe we rarely think about it. Between the generation that grew up before Hiroshima and afterwards. And this is what Nuttall wrote. He said, "By dropping atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we had espoused an evil as great as the Nazi genocide. We had espoused the instrument for the termination of our benevolent institution, society, and our certain identity, human. We had espoused a monstrous uncertainty, both of future and of morality." Well, I thought about that quote. I mean, should I put it in the book? Does it hold up? Does it make sense? And I kept coming back to the word espoused. He says, "We had espoused a monstrous uncertainty of both future and of morality." And I think that he's absolutely got it right. Because the espousal was of the most incontrovertible sort, not with words, but with actions. When you drop an atomic bomb on Hiroshima, when you drop it on Nagasaki, when you, as the U.S. government has done, lead the way for planning to incinerate the planet with the latest of technology, and made as a point of national pride, a willingness, as JFK did, as every president since has, that we are ready, willing, and able, and patriotically eager, if the time comes, like the general who called me from the Pentagon, to use those weapons. And this is something else that Nuttall said I'd like to share with you. He, in a sense, said that those who claim certainty of a future were part of a culture of hoax. They were fakers. This is the way he put it. "No longer could teacher, magistrate, politician, don, or even loving parent guide the young. Their membership of the H-bomb society automatically canceled anything they might have to say on questions of right and wrong. Even nature had come to mean poison stratosphere, contaminated rain, vegetables and milk that made men breed monsters." Well, of course, He was alluding to nuclear fallout. I have strontium-90 in my bones. All of us who are alive during the nuclear bomb testing of the 50s and 60s, atmospheric testing, the strontium-90, like calcium, bone-seeking, the fallout went to the pastures, to the cows, to the milk on the shelves, to our bodies. And that entire process, I think, along with being a literal combination of what we call politics and life, is also a metaphor. You know, if you're not into politics, politics is still into you. That's a message we failed to convey to the population as a whole. It's that close, strontium-90 in our own bones. In 1980, I went to southern Utah, and I visited a woman named Irma Thomas. She was in her late 70s at that point. Irma lived in a community, if you've been to St. George, you know what I'm talking about, in southern Utah. Very few people smoked cigarettes, heavily Mormon community. She had counted in a one-block radius of her home 31 people with cancer. Between 1951 and 1962, the fallout had blown through southern Utah with a chorus from the U.S. government. There is no danger. And not only that, the people who were enduring that fallout were told to be proud that they were participating in this exercise of nuclear bomb testing. And Eisenhower, in the 50s, had said that, in fact, the bombs had to keep going off in Nevada and the Pacific, where Pacific Islanders were really being massacred with cancer and leukemia as well, because actually the scientists were going to protect us. Those who were endangering us were actually going to protect us. They were going to make a clean bomb. Well, Irma Thomas and her neighbors experienced the result of that kind of faith, and this is what she said. She said that they had trusted, all of her neighbors had trusted the U.S. government, that they had been told there was nothing to fear whatsoever, and that they felt proud of what they were doing. This is the exact quote which she spoke into my tape recorder. "We're not numbers, we're not statistics, we're human beings. They couldn't pay anyone for the loss of a child. I hope they realize that. We accepted all this. It was our government, and we accepted it." And I want to close on that note. It's our government in 2007, and we accept it. And I use the "we" advisedly, but consciously, because as I've traveled around the country quite often at gatherings such as this one, the question comes up sooner or later, and it's an appropriate question. Well, this is all well and good, but aren't we just preaching to the choir? And I've come to think that while that is a legitimate concern, and we all need to find ways to reach out, to communicate, to speak, and to listen, and to be in conversation with people throughout all sectors of society, however we may conceptualize that or divide it up in our heads or demographically or every which way, that there was nobody in the choir who couldn't learn how to sing better. And a challenge to us is to find ways, not as some sort of abstraction and not as some sort of stretch outside of ourselves, but on the contrary, from inside ourselves, to find ways that not only can we sing better, but that we can challenge the warfare state better. Because it's our passivity that is allowing this warfare state to continue. And if we can find better ways to challenge the warfare state in all of its manifestations, then it will be in retreat instead of continuing to advance. James Baldwin reflected on the fact that, as he put it, and the quote is in the latest book, because I couldn't resist putting it in, he said that he felt, ultimately, human beings are bound to be very disappointing, that unfortunately most people will be a disappointment to us. And yet, he added, ultimately, what's most important and where the hope of the world is has to do not with what others choose to do, but what we choose to do ourselves. Thank you for being here tonight.
Thank you, Norman. We're going to bring Norman back up together with our next speaker for questions and answers and discussion. There's something about the letter D. You know, defense, we can take the capitalization off, but also Democrat. And our next speaker may tell you a little bit about the distinction between a capital D Democrat and a lowercase Democrat. And I hope also can start us down the path from what we've just heard is wrong to what we can do about it. Laura Flanders is here from New York. She is the host of Radio Nation, the only show on both America and Pacifica, and the best show on either, and a show that treats listeners as citizens and activists, not as spectators. She has a number of books, most recently Blue Grit, The Democrats, lowercase, Take Back Politics from the Politicians. Excuse me, True Democrats, that's my handwriting. Blue Grit, True Democrats, Take Back Politics from the Politicians. And another is Bush Women, Tales of a Cynical Species, which I understand includes Condoleezza Rice, the Sally Hemings of today. And another one is The W Effect, Sexual Politics in the Age of Bush. Laura Flanders has been on the Washington Journal, on the Donahue Show, on many television programs whose names will not pass my lips, and she has written in The Nation, in Ms. Magazine, in the San Francisco Chronicle. She also spent 10 years producing Counterspin, the radio show for FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, which remains one of the best organizations critiquing the media today. It is great pleasure and privilege for us to have Laura Flanders with us here tonight.
Thank you, David. What a beautiful job. And thank you, everybody, that is making tonight's event possible. I really appreciate you being here on a beautiful Sunday evening. It's very nice artwork we have here, don't you think? It's a special little sculpture. How high can we rise? How many objects without them toppling over? Yeah, I worked for many years in community radio and grassroots radio and Pacifica radio and public radio. And then in 2004, when Air America got started, there weren't a whole lot of people who had an experience of doing progressive talk radio on the non-commercial band and also on the commercial band. And I had some experience working for Working Assets, the phone company. How many of you are all Working Assets subscribers? They give away $25 million a year to progressive causes. They had started in 1999, a progressive left commercial radio station in Boulder, Colorado, where I did a show for 4 hours a day with, I think, no listeners and no ads. So that was good experience, and we found there were big mountains out there, which they hadn't calculated on, and in fact, our signal couldn't get past the mountains, so... You know, we had a few listeners. Anyway, so by the time Air America came around, they were looking for hosts, and I got signed up. So I did a show with a very different kind of audience, like the public radio audience, particularly the Pacifica audience, the people who are very involved in movement politics. They can tell you everything about the peace movement. They can tell you everything about the environmental movement, the women's movement, civil rights, you name it. But come around election time, they're actually unable to talk much about elections because of 501c3 nonprofit tax regs. So it's not the place to go if you want to know what election is happening in your community. Air America, the audience, very different. Their idea of politics really is electoral politics. That was pretty much all you would hear. So I thought, these two communities need to meet. You know, important. I think elections are important to some extent. I also don't think they're the be-all and end-all. I certainly don't think presidential elections are the only ones that count. So anyway, that's to give you some sense of what I brought into the studio on election night 2004, namely myself and this sense of audience. And it was at Air America, very possibly the listening audience for Air America is the most reflective of activist and liberal democratic voters. Most of the people who listen to Air America, to judge from those that call in, were people that were going to vote for John Kerry and Edwards, who had worked really, really hard all election year, had done more than they'd ever done in any election. They hadn't just registered to vote. They'd gotten their friends to register to vote. They'd left their homes and traveled across the country to knock on strangers' doors. They'd given money. They'd given time. They'd given names out of their phone books. They'd really poured their heart and soul into that race. And even if they weren't so excited about Kerry Edwards, they really wanted to get, George and Dick out of the White House. And so election night, Al Franken got the cocktail hour shift. I don't know how these things are assigned, but he got 7 to 11, and he was partying up with John Kerry in Boston. At least they were partying for a while. And as I was walking uptown listening, because I'm radio addicted, I was listening to the radio on my headphones, and I heard everybody sounding very cheery. The polls were, the exit polls were making it look like Edwards Kerry were going to win, and by the time I got to the studio, I thought, well, we're going to be having a celebration, and it's going to be my job to tamp down everybody's expectations of the next Democratic presidency. As you all know, by the time I got on the air, I got the graveyard shift from midnight to 5 a.m., things were very different. I describe it as in the book as the night of the politically living dead. It was as if people had seen one too many of those vote or die posters and hadn't really counted on doing both. So I spent the evening trying to cheer people up. Somebody once called me an optaholic, and it's a description I think that fits. I spent the evening trying to cheer people up and saying things like, it's not all bad. Some so-called red states managed to raise the minimum wage by a dollar. Nevada and Florida, they got a ballot measure on the ballot. They got it passed in every county by a 2-to-1 margin. Every county of those two states, rich and poor, rural, urban, liberal, conservative, that's good news. And then I said, there's some good news from Montana. You got the first Democratic governor in 16 years. They flipped both houses of the state government. That's good news. And then I went home and I thought, am I dreaming? Am I just making this stuff up? So I said, because I actually do believe in journalism, which is to say leaving the studio, I decided to go out and look what was happening around the country. And I'll tell you, that's where Blue Grit came from. And I'll just read a little bit to give you an idea of what's in it. The first place I went was the reddest place I could find on the map, which was Utah. And I did meet some of the people from southern Utah who talked about why they were not so keen on nuclear power. Anyway, it's been a while since I've read from this book, so I don't have it as... I have it too marked up. When you start out on a book tour, you only have a few little tabs, so you know where you want to go, and then by this point you've... So anyway, I went out to Utah. I did not expect that it would be in Utah that I would meet my first transgendered church minister, but it was. The Reverend Sean Parker Dennison, the bearded leader of the South Valley Unitarian Universalist Society, takes services every week in a modern pine and concrete building whose gables are as high-pitched as his preaching voice. As I searched for progressive change in unexpected places, I was looking for surprises, but Reverend Dennison was more than surprising. His smile, his beard, and his voice screamed anywhere but Utah. On the Sunday before the Dr. King holiday, families filed through the front doors of the Reverend South Valley Unitarian beneath a large hate-free zone rainbow flag hanging over the entrance. The service featured a reading of a short biography of Dr. King and a poem by Mary Oliver, the lesbian naturalist. "We have a dream of community where all are accepted," sermonized the round-faced reverend. The 100 or so congregants nodded in agreement, their heads bobbing an assortment of ski caps, suburban blue rinses, and sandy-colored Rasta wannabes. Be dreadlocks. Utah, I go on to say, is hardly the world's most tranny welcoming spot. It's better known for its adoration of lackluster Republican presidents and Mormon edicts than for any fondness towards those whose gender expression is out of the ordinary. Salt Lake City, just down the road from the South Valley Church, is home to the world headquarters of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, known colloquially as the Mormon Church. The LDS Church has some very fixed ideas about gender. Transgendered she-he people have no place in the church handbook, but homosexuals do. They're punishable by excommunication, followed by eternal damnation, as if one wasn't enough. Then I go on to talk about Utah. You know, this is a place that gave Bush his highest thumbs-up numbers right up until I was there, which was 2006. It was a place that was still giving a high approval ratings to Nixon, even after he was impeached. This country is a confusing spot, a confusing place, because actually Utah looks as red as it does on the map. Salt Lake City is a progressive place and has a radical mayor. Salt Lake City's mayor, anybody know him? Rocky Anderson. He's a guy who, when the president comes to town, doesn't greet him with a motorcade and lunch in the town hall. He greets him with the most massive anti-war demonstration the state has ever seen, and he excoriates him from the steps of the town hall. So, you know, this image we have of our country of this kind of blue on the outside and red on the inside place is very misleading. Every city in the country, like this one, every city with 500,000 or more votes Democratic, half the cities with 50,000 or more do. There's more to this country and who's in it than meets the eye. So the book goes out to try to find out what's happening around the country. And of course, I come back at this point with good news and bad news. And I'll start with the bad. The bad's pretty obvious, you know. Almost a year after we elect, you know, this country elected a Democratic majority to Congress, specifically to end the war in Iraq. There are more troops deployed in Iraq than ever. In case you're ever curious about that, the fact is 41% of all voters, when polled in exit polls, were told pollsters that exiting Iraq was their most pressing concern. 70% of Democrats said that. And yet, after all this time, there are more troops there than ever, and the Democratic majority keeps continuing the war by voting more money for the war when they don't need to do that. We have an administration that continues to justify what they don't call torture, but anybody in their right minds would call torture. And this week we found out that even as they were saying to Congress that they were cleaning up their act and signing this or that law, they were actually sending memos around the back of Congress and around the back of the public to assure their interrogators that a little bit of torture was all right. And not just a little, but a lot, 100 different techniques at once on one person in a period of a week. And we have a Democratic majority that, in response to violations of our civil liberties and privacy rights, far from reining in the president's spying powers, voted last summer to expand them, give him more rights to search our homes and seize our property without even bothering to go to a court. We have Democratic candidates, the top three of which, when asked in an MSNBC debate last week if they could commit to withdrawing troops from Iraq by 2013, not one of them could commit. Barack Obama said it would be irresponsible. Responsibility should be to us. We'll tell him what's irresponsible. All of the candidates, not a single one, would challenge the questioner when he asked them for their favorite Bible verse. Not one said that is an inappropriate question. We don't have Christian loyalty oaths in government in this country. That's why we were founded. So we have a president who this week said, this country does not engage in torture. And it sounded to me an awful lot like another Republican president in 1986, round about this time of the year, who told the country, we did not sell weapons or any other thing to Iran. And the people didn't believe him then, and the people don't believe George W. Bush now, and the people were right then. They found out 2 weeks later his administration had done exactly that. And we're going to find out exactly the same thing again this season. We know it in our hearts. And then the question becomes, well, what are the Democrats and what are we going to do about it? And I don't think we are necessarily the same thing. The good news, as I said, is that there are what I call blue grit grassroots Democrats, big and little D, stepping up and filling a vacuum that the leadership of the Democratic Party has left around the country, where a functioning, people-oriented party could be. In Montana, it wasn't just what they called a miracle that Brian Schweitzer got elected. Brian Schweitzer, the cowboy governor, He was interviewed on CNN. He was interviewed on ABC. Mostly they focused on his cowboy boots and his bolo tie, to the point where you would think that all that took to get him elected was wearing cowboy boots and a bolo tie and being able to wrestle a calf. They talked about the Montana miracle, and I was always a bit skeptical. I think women are always a little skeptical when we hear about miracles. It's kind of like the miracle of motherhood. They leave out the 9 months and all the misery. And this was the same thing, focusing just on the product. Brian Schweitzer got elected. Was kind of like focusing on the beaming baby and ignoring the 9 months of mom. In Montana, what had made a difference was not him striding into town in cowboy boots. What had made a difference was 10 years of work by grassroots organizations, namely not just the Democratic Party, although that party in Montana had been written off by the Democrats in Washington many, many years ago in 1984. So it had been blissfully free of the kind of bad advice Democratic consultants give Democrats around the country. And they'd actually done a pretty good job, such that the Democratic Party there was headed up by a man who used to come from an environmental organization and believed it would be a good idea to talk to the environmentalists. But what really had made the difference in Montana was 10 years of work by an environmental group called Montana Environmental Voters, a 41-member strong coalition of women's organizations called Montana Women Vote that had done things like focus specifically on getting low-income women to vote. And well, how do you do that? Well, you run low-income women for office. So they ran people, this coalition, not the Democratic Party, this coalition ran a woman who, his name is Mary Cafaro. She's a former welfare recipient. She lives in Helena, Montana. Gorgeous, long black hair, Italian family, about this tall with a very large dog and four kids under 18. And her friend said, "You can't run for office. You're about this high, got a very large dog, and you got four kids under 18. And she said, "We can do this. We can do it." And sure enough, she did it. Her kids in tow, they put up the yard signs. She knocked doors for a year. And when people asked her where she stood on abortion, she said she was for abortion rights for all women, and that was a detail of her platform. And when they asked her where she stood on gay marriage, she said, "I'm for marriage equality. I'm for equality. Now can we talk about something else?" When they asked her where she stood on the war, she said, "I was against it before it began. I'm against it now." And she increased the vote in her constituency by something like 30%. She got a 30% increase in turnout. And those voters, while they were voting for her, also voted for Brian Schweitzer because, hey, why not? But she was the person they were talking to around their kitchen tables. They only saw him on television. So she got a bigger margin of victory in her district than he did. And yet traditional political pundits would have you believe in trickle-down theory, which is why it's important to support the person at the top. Because the person at the top of the platform, the top of the ticket, will maybe help the people below. I don't believe it works that way. I think the people at the below, who actually talk face-to-face to people, help the people at the top whose face they never see, whether they wear a bolo tie or not. The bad news I found out was that in much of the country, Nevada, for example, well, let's talk about much of the country. In much of the country, Democrats weren't even fielding a team. Now, I'm not saying Democrats are the ideal people in the world, but if even Democrats don't have a functioning office, you can be sure that people have very little idea how to communicate with the progressive point of view in their state. And I know that because I talked to people in Mississippi and in Alabama who said, "I didn't know what else to call except for a Democratic Party because when I was against the war, or when I was worried that we would go to war after 9/11. But when I called the Democratic Party office, nobody answered the call." Mississippi had one person working there for the last 8 years alone, part-time. Now, Nevada, you would think Nevada would be a well-endowed place because, well, Nevada is where the Senate Majority Leader comes from, Harry Reid. So I went to Nevada to see how a functioning and exciting Democratic Party works. And I write about it in a chapter that is called "Where's the Party?" Okay. I talk about people who say, you know, if the problem is we don't have enough loyalty. The Democrats don't have enough loyalty from people like labor groups and environmentalists and women. They're constantly fractious, you know, behaving in a fractious kind of way around the margin. It's difficult to keep everything together. So I say critics would be better positioned to criticize the interest groups, that's what they're called, and call them to work more closely within the party if there was anything resembling a vibrant party in most states. Then I go on to talk about Nevada. Thanks to Harry Reid, the Nevada State Party is actually in comparatively good shape. But I couldn't help wincing about how recent that state of affairs is. In early 2006, when I was there, I met a woman called Allison Schwartz, who directed the party's field campaign in 2004. She was very excited. She said, a Democratic candidate could win this place. Absolutely, it's possible. It's just going to take some work. We continued talking. She goes on to say that she's thrilled about what she calls the new Democratic Party machine in the state. Why new, I ask, with some trepidation. As Schwartz puts it, it's new because before 2004, things here were pretty skeletal. A political consultant who preferred to remain anonymous put it more bluntly, before Reid took over leadership, there was no party in this state. For example, there was no computerized voting roll. While the Republicans were sending in their newly registered voters with little palm pilots to head office and didn't have to go back to head office to do that, Democrats had to go back, leaf through these long, people would volunteer from California, they came in, they had to leaf through these ridiculous books like this, you've probably all done it, add it all in with a paper and pencil, and then what happened to that nice record? It'd be put in a cabinet until the next election. How fast is the turnover of the population in a place like Las Vegas? It doubles every 10 years. So that's not like wine, it doesn't get better with age. They also, this year, thanks to Harry Reid, managed to hire a communications director full-time. I said, well, that's good. You didn't have one of those before? They never had one until 2004. Five. Think of Karen Hughes. I wrote a book about the Bush women. Karen Hughes, you don't hear much about until she hems to the White House, but she was head of the Republican Party in Texas from about 1988. Now, why do you think they might have wanted to have a Republican Party head of the of a Texas Republican Party who's a woman around about 1988? Because that's when Ann Richards, Molly Ivins' friend, became governor. So they didn't want to have some nasty, you know, redneck old guy criticizing Ann Richards. They had a fresh-faced, blonde, blue-eyed woman who criticized Ann Richards every single day. So by the time George Bush got to run against her, she was wounded already. It was Karen Hughes who had done the wounding. And she'd done it as communications director for the Republican Party. Which is just, I'm thinking of my poor listeners, my Air America listeners, and thinking, they had no idea how poorly served they were being by the people for whom they were working so hard. Now the good news, I said I would bring you good news, is that after all these years of what I call a penthouse party, all top floor suites, no power in the streets, really no staircase linking the floors, that's what the Clinton Democratic Party had built. After all those years, there is a little bit of a rabble rising. There is a little bit of a rabble, like Mary Cafaro, like the Allison Schwartzes, like the people who are getting active in states like Mississippi and Nevada and Utah and you name it. There are a bunch of people who are saying, you know, the reality is when you look at this Democratic Party, there is nobody driving the bus. And that's both bad news, because there's nobody driving the bus, and good news, because maybe we could drive the bus, or maybe better yet, we could build a plane. And a lot of them are doing that, and I think that's what you saw in this last election. It wasn't just the wonderful payoff of the great work by Rahm Emanuel. I don't think it was that. I think it was the work of people like the Blue Grit Democrats that I'm talking about, people who decided to make the war an issue of that election, whether Rahm Emanuel, the head of the Congressional Campaign Committee, wanted it to be an issue or not. I think it was people like Carol Shea Porter who decided to run for office in New Hampshire, in the first district of New Hampshire, on an anti-war platform, even though Rahm Emanuel told her not to run. He told her her district wasn't competitive, she couldn't win it, and the war would be a terrible thing to run on. And she said she believed her district was competitive, that she could win it, and she was going to damn well run on the war because that was the issue of the day. And she pulled together a little kitchen cabinet of grandmothers who were against the war, and she turned that district around. Now, the sad news about Carol Shea Porter, and I talked about this yesterday, but the sad news about Carol Shea Porter, good woman with good backers, people who care a lot, was that in 2007, when she comes into Washington, she sets up her office, never been in an office in Washington before, sets up her office, putting her things in place. She gets taken on one of those official embedded tours of Iraq. where you're basically embedded in the green zone. You never meet an Iraqi. And she gets introduced to the troops, and the troops are always powerful when you meet them. And I don't think she'd ever got introduced to any of them before, certainly not in a war zone. And she comes back from Iraq, and the first thing she's asked to do by the House leadership is vote for the supplemental bill, more money for Iraq. And she's thinking, well, I got to run for office again in a few years, and do I really want to become an enemy of the leadership right now? I just got here. I barely know where the bathrooms are. She's thinking, well, maybe we can turn this into an anti-war vote somehow, even though we're giving more money to the war. And she's thinking of those troops. Well, the media will say I'm against the troops. So she voted for the war, because she voted for more money for the war. And now she has to answer to all those people who backed her up. So I think what we're learning, you know, Thomas Jefferson talked about democracy as both a means and an end. It's not just what we're working for, but in the exercise of our democracy, we become more democratic. We also become more empowered. We're talking little d democracy now at this point. I think the good news is that because of the vacuum that had been left for so long by the Democratic Party, they are simply asleep at the switchness of this party. A lot of people have moved into action that hadn't been in that kind of action before, which is they hadn't been in any kind of electoral activity before. And a lot of my listeners who had done nothing other than vote are now repeatedly, routinely doing more than voting. And they're getting it, that it's not just about the president. Maybe it's about their school board. Maybe it's about their county commission. I think in 2000, we discovered we had to do it for ourselves. I mean, I first woke up to the sort of vacuum that is the Democratic Party when I was in election year on Air America Radio and hearing from callers. Callers were calling into my show saying, how do I get a yard sign for Kerry Edwards? And I would think, I live in New York. I don't even have a yard, let alone a yard sign. What do I know? And I would direct them to the Kerry Edwards website. And finally, some blessed listener called in and said, listen, stop. I've already gone to the Kerry Edwards website, and there is no way to get a yard sign. Most states have no party that has a functioning website either, or at least they didn't in that election. So the good news is a lot of people are filling in those gaps. They're finding ways to raise money. They're running candidates that the establishment wouldn't want them to run. They're running on issues the establishment wouldn't want them to run on. In 2000, I think we all learned that we have to monitor our own voting. And people are doing that. We've learned for years, thanks to the work of Norman and groups like FAIR, that we have to make our own media. We've learned in 2004 that we have to turn out our own voters, because the Democratic Party sure isn't going to do it. And in 2006, I think what people learned is we have to run on our own issues regardless of what the party says. In 2007, we find ourselves in a very tough spot. I think in 2008, we're going to be disappointed. We're not going to get all the change that we want. And I think looking ahead 2012 and beyond, we have to be thinking about maybe we don't only need to monitor our own votes and make our own media and run our own candidates and run on our own issues. Maybe we really need to make our own candidates. Maybe we really need to make our own structure such that the people that run are actually accountable to us. But that's just maybe. I'll end with a quote, just a passage from the end of the book about some of the people who are getting engaged in this process and the question I think they pose to all of us and to the Democratic Party. The last chapter is about the movement for voting, for actual voting that counts and gets counted. It's called Mobbing Up. All right, so as the 2007 Congress settles down to work and the fundraising cycle for the 08 election starts, young people like Robert Biko Baker are looking for change, not just in Congress, but in their lives. A high school soccer coach and scholarship student at the University of California at Los Angeles, Baker put his doctorate on hold in order to come home to Milwaukee to organize voters in 2004. The group he formed with the help of the dynamic young people's organization, the League of Independent Voters. They used to be called the League of Pissed Off Voters, but they couldn't get on the radio, so they changed their name. The group he formed with the help of the League trained a core of local hip-hop musicians and young performer poets to walk their blocks. They knocked on doors for 4 months in a part of town where a young person with a clipboard is a far, far more unusual sight than a roadside shrine to a murder victim. In 2005, 140 people were killed in these streets. Just days before the 2004 election, the neighborhood was plastered with leaflets warning residents, spuriously of course, that if they'd ever received a parking ticket, they couldn't vote. The population that was targeted, mostly black, mostly unemployed, wasn't the typically voting kind. Nonetheless, Baker's group registered and turned out, regardless, 14,000 voters that year, 3,000 more than John Kerry's margin in the entire state. The new activists were elated. Those kids said it was the best night of their lives, said Baker. He sent them home that night without telling them that Kerry lost. In the 2 years since, instead of just decamping and coming back 4 years later, this group decided to stay around. In the 2 years since, Baker's group has evolved into a year-round campaign, the Campaign Against Violence, which operates out of an old Carpenters Union hall in a part of North Milwaukee they call Little Beirut. Since 2004, the campaign never stopped working its blocks. We're on these blocks and we're from these blocks, said Baker. In 2006, the campaign registered 3,100 new voters and increased turnout in its precincts by between 5% and in some places as much as 55%. In our target wards, we mobilized about 12,000 voters, a tired Baker told me late November 8th. That's in a midterm race. By the end of the season, the campaign was signing up 100 new voters a night. And even high schoolers as young as 15 were knocking on doors. The older folks in the hood couldn't get over seeing young kids in baggy jeans telling them to vote. They loved it. In Wisconsin, Democrats took control of the state Senate, gaining 4 seats. In the legislature, they narrowed the gap, knocking out 4 GOP incumbents. The only big irregularity complaints came from high turnout. Voting lines were very long. People say young cats aren't serious, but no one wants change more than these young people, Baker said. For evidence, he points to one event in the 2004 campaign. When the newspaper reported that the local county mayor was not planning to print the legally required number of ballots, 40 or 50 campaign members walked into the mayor's office and interrupted a press conference. There's some question about whether these young men actually stood on the mayor's desk during that press conference, and I think they probably did. Having signed up so many voters, the group wasn't about to see any new registrants turned away. I called my people together and said, look, we need to mob up and handle this, William Campbell, president of the Black Student Union at the local technical college, told me. And we took care of it. Milwaukee printed the full complement of ballots. Now Baker wants to know whether the Democratic Party is finally serious. We'll find out soon enough, he sighs. We're here. We're not going away. So far, the party doesn't seem to care. Is the party ready to mob up for the likes of Biko? Or is it not? Thanks.
I'm going to ask Laura and Norman to take a couple of these chairs up here to answer questions, and I'm going to try to turn this microphone around and put it down here so that people can come right up here in the middle and ask a question.
You think Tina should be up here with us too?
Tina?
Come on.
Jay, you want to be up here? So I'm going to turn the mic around here if I can do it without breaking it. And please, if you want to ask a question, come right up in the middle and ask a question to a specific person or to anyone. And please make it a question. But make it an acceptable question. If you ask about vote counting, we're going to tackle and taser you. if it's an acceptable question, we'll give you an answer. Okay.
Thank you for coming this evening. Laura mentioned about Rahm Emanuel, and his name frequently comes up a lot on the Tom Hartman show and once in a while on Randy Rhoads. Do you think the real problem for the Democrats is not so much the Republicans, but is actually the advisors and the people that Emanuel seems to listen to, the people who want them to be Republican light?
Yeah, I think you're right. The problem for the you know, we people who would like to have a functioning Democratic Party, or at least a functioning alternative party, is that the party we've got is headed up by people, Rahm Emanuel is just a symbol. It's by people who are terrified of their base and who have structured their party, and I mean structured it. It's not just attitudes, but structure. Who gets what money where? Structured it so that base barely gets to have an impact, barely gets to be heard. And when, for example, a candidate like Christine Sigelis in Illinois, it's Rahm Emanuel's home state, decides that she's going to run on an anti-war platform. She ran against Henry Hyde in 2004 in a midterm election, an out-of-sequence election. Famous, well-entrenched Republican. She got 44% of the vote. She was an airline steward who got voters out in her district and contains the O'Hare Airport. You know, when somebody like that wants to run 2 years later, you think, well, damn, she just got 44% of the vote against one of the Republicans' most famous and powerful people. You would think she could win now. Hyde has retired. She's up against some brand newbie on the Republican side, a Tom DeLay aide, in fact. You would think you would rush to Christine Sigelis and say, please run. You would certainly think that a party that says they do not take sides in primaries would not take sides in the primary. What Rahm Emanuel did, in fact, was go to six different people until he found one who would run against her. She lived outside the district, Tammy Duckworth, a double amputee from the Iraq War, and he ran Tammy Duckworth against Sigelis and outspent her 10-1. And Sigelis still only lost, I think, 54, something like that, percent. She got, it was 44, 47, something like that, percent. So that's what we're talking about. It's not just coincidence, it's strategy, and it's political. I spoke to Christine the other day, and I said, well, you know, how do they explain that they lost? Because Tammy Duckworth went on to lose. And they said, well, she said, well, Tammy Duckworth agreed with them on NAFTA, on the war, and on health care. They want to keep a private health care system. And I want single-payer, publicly financed health care, and I never would have gone into this war, and I would bring the troops out, and I'm against NAFTA, CAFTA, and every other kind of shafta that's out there. And I said, well, but they lost. And she said, well, you know what, they didn't, because the Republican who's in that seat shares all those positions.
Yeah, some might ask, I'd add, and this is a generalization, so there are exceptions, but in general, the best thing about Democratic Party office holders is Republicans. Maybe I need to explain that. Democrats look good because of Republicans. Compared to, Republicans are so crazy in many ways. I don't mean psychologically. I mean in terms of their positions. Let me rephrase that. Their positions are so whacked out in so many ways that they make Democratic Party office holders look good. And so the best argument that Democratic mainstream officials have for getting our votes is that they're not as bad as Republicans, although that's sometimes debatable, but it's usually true. The worst thing about Democratic Party office holders is Democratic Party office holders. And when you really look at the positions that they're taking, whether it's NAFTA, CAFTA, or so many other issues, they need to be confronted. So I think that if you look at who's been managing the presidential campaigns of the Democratic Party candidates, going back, who's the one that has like an unbroken record of 8 losses in a row? Squires? Yeah, Shrum. So, you know, it's the meritocracy. He keeps coming back and managing campaigns after losing them. And this is the reality that we're looking at.
I mean, I will say, because I am that optaholic that I mentioned, that there are people that are getting that the structure can be penetrated from the bottom up. Now, we've just started. I mean, people, I think, have really only just started. But I did find all across the country people running not just for elected office but for Democratic Party office. And in places like North Carolina, for example, progressive Democrats, like those who work with Progressive Democrats of America, have managed to take control. It only needs, if you all went to a meeting, if a quarter of you went to a meeting, you would be outnumbering the other people there 2-1. You could get yourself elected in a minute if you actually decided to go to those meetings. And in North Carolina, that's exactly what they did. And they didn't elect the guy that the party wanted to inherit the chairmanship of the party. They elected a progressive. And we'll see what happens. I mean, I think this is the very early stages of a process. Whoever wanted to get involved in Democratic Party office holding? Not most of us. But there are some stalwart souls out there who are trying to make a difference from the bottom. And whether he's going to be able to continue it for much longer or not, we don't know. But Howard Dean, up until today, still is chair of the Democratic National Committee, and he has still given enough money. He gave in 2005 enough money to all of the state parties to hire 4 workers. So at least there is a functioning office that returned the call of the guy I met in Mississippi this last year. We'll see where that goes.
And if I can just ask a follow-up, it seems how Howard Dean has basically been proven right with his strategies.
You and me, not to the Clintonites out there.
Why is it that they can't, do you think that he just keeps getting so much opposition?
Well, think about it. How would you want to rule your own personal party? Would you want the power to be dispersed across a whole friggin' country to lots of people who might be activists? Or would you rather be able to raise the money from your friends in the Lincoln bedroom and decide who to give money to at election time?
Well, it depends if I was running a democracy or a dictatorship.
Well, if you could do the latter and call it a democracy, not to mention the Democratic Party, you'd get the best of both worlds. And I do want to say, I'll stop, but it is not just coincidence that I think the rot that I write about here really set in. The party structure changed not just at some random time. It changed in the middle of the 1960s. Why the middle of the 1960s? Well, because the middle of the 1960s is when the Democratic Party supported the Civil Rights Act. They were pushed to do that by a movement, a grassroots movement. And people like Ella Baker and others organized people, Fannie Lou Hamer organized the Miami Freedom Democratic Party to get African Americans registered to vote. And when they came back to the party and said, okay, well, we've got a delegation that could replace your white segregated whites only party delegation from this state of Mississippi, the party said, well, we don't dare unseat that delegation right now. And it was at that moment, I think, the party sort of decided, we want the votes of the civil rights movement, but we don't want the activists of the civil rights movement. And it was at that moment you saw the party structure shift, so that instead of going from the bottom up and powerful city and state bosses, you started going from the top down and powerful White House and congressional and Senate office holders. So, in America, here in Virginia, we need to remember there are specifics, and they often have to do with racism.
Well, suddenly I'm for voting. I remember when I first voted as a citizen in Alabama, when I came back after the Korean War back in 1954, when you could count the votes of black people almost on your hands and toes just a year before the Montgomery bus boycott. But I do feel that we're going to have to be concerned with more than voting if we are going to accomplish what needs to be done. I think at this point we are placing too much emphasis on voting, and the reason for that it being the lobbies are controlling this matter. Yeah. The lobbies are the highest paid people. They got more money. They are getting people to do things. They're manipulating. They're spinning. And so it means then that the vote does not mean what we think it means in this process. But I'm more concerned about the Iraq war right now. I'm wearing on my breast, and I've been telling people recently I've been getting more attention on the upper part of my anatomy than Hillary Clinton when she wears a low cut. So I guess that's good news. But anyway,
from the Washington Post, though. You're not getting more attention from the Washington Post than Hillary Clinton is, but from other people, maybe.
A friend here has on his chest, Y3815 plus. And you're going to have to tell me what the TAPS is.
That's where I usually ask people who don't know what this means to begin. I ask them, what comes to your mind when you think of the
taps,
word on the bottom?
Taps.
And I say, what do you...
Funerals.
Okay, now I say, connect that to the numbers and what comes to your mind?
Got it. dead in Iraq, U.S.
The number of people killed in Iraq. So it gives them a conscience-raising opportunity rather than just to say, this is the number killed in Iraq. We get into conversation.
That's
what
right.
You're talking about, communication. So I am concerned, though, whether or not at this point in the juncture, should we not be employing some other tactics and strategy rather than talking about accomplishing some of the things that need to be accomplished by voting? Now, you mentioned some of the people earlier in the civil rights bill. I was in the Montgomery bus boycott. But should we not have some kind of a direct action, and how do we go about getting that? Because we got to have something that's going to get the attention of the people in power. And I don't think what we are doing is getting that attention.
Well, no doubt. No doubt there's no silver bullet. It's not voting. It's not one kind of protest or another. I think any movement that's going to have a long-term powerful success is going to need to employ a wide range of strategies. Legal marches and rallies, nonviolent civil disobedience, voter registration, campaigns, ballot measures, media work, neighborhood organizing, and I've just begun to discuss them. But I think that you're quite right that you don't want to emphasize one facet. And we need a flexibility there. But I think if you look at what needs to happen across the country at any time, it needs to be all of those.
I mean, if we're going to be brutally honest here, and I hope that Tina weighs in on this as well, I will say, as I traveled around the country looking for good news, I found it in the area of people who had never been involved in electoral politics getting involved at different levels. I did not find, nor do I really feel, a rising tide of direct action happening around this country, or a movement that has to do with breaking the laws or refusing to obey. You have military who are refusing to return to service. I think we've got about at least 2,000 official AWOL, meaning we know about them, and there's probably thousands more. I know that Iraq Veterans Against the War get something like 3,000 calls a week from people, or a month, looking for help about how not to serve. But I don't know what the other people here would say, but I'm not feeling it in the way that I felt it. I was very involved in the peace movement in the 80s. You could feel it then. You could feel it in the movement against the war in Central America, with sister city churches and sanctuary churches and nuclear-free zones. And I don't know. We're not in the middle of it yet.
One thing that I think that I've been noticing a lot in the last 9 months especially, but in the last couple of years of my activism, and I was a regional coordinator for Military Families Speak Out in the Midwest, and is that I see a lot of great people wanting to organize and do things, but I see some organizations that are trying to direct things from the treetops. You know, people organizing, want to organize a march and feel really passionate about this is what we need to do and this is how we need to do it. And they go to the organization and say, well, we need your endorsement so you can help us get the word out. And they go, well, no, we really don't like that idea. And it's killing part of the movement. But part of what I try to do is helping to organize from the grassroots. When a community has an idea or a state and they really want it to propel it, they really want to do it, this is what they're passionate about, I try to provide the tools and resources for them to get the word out and to really do it from the grassroots and up, so that it's the people actually directing where the organizations go, not the organizations trying to direct where the people go. And that's one of the struggles that I've seen. So I've started to have a computer technician hired now to construct a database that will be open to all peace organizations, no matter how big or small they are, so that they'll be able to connect with other organizations within their community, within their state, within their region, within the nation, so that this communication is now going to be controlled from the bottom up, from the people, not whether another organization decides that they're going to get you know, let you do this. And to really get that energy and movement, I think I helped organize the September 15th march, and we saw a lot of that. Part of that was the postering. People saw the YouTube of me postering, and that's what I faced the 6 months in jail now for. And with as much people that I received emails and calls that said that when they saw what happened, that they realized they didn't realize how bad things were, but now that they did, they felt compelled to get involved. And not only are they getting involved by going to the march, but they started getting involved in their own communities. They started Grassroots America chapters down in the reddest of the red parts of the states, because they felt that this needed to be more, because there's no way our country has gotten this bad. And that's what I'm hoping more and more people will see, that and be willing to stand up, and even if they charge in with mounted police and SWAT teams to take you out just because you want to put up an anti-war poster, you know, it is time for our country, for every one of us, to really start standing up. And it's only when we stand up and defy when they tell us, you know, you can't do something, and we go ahead and do it anyway, that's when you get to find out whether you still have your Constitution intact or not. That is the only time you get to find out. And so I hope that, you know, by what I do and by what others do, really standing up and facing that down will inspire others to do the same. Because when we have a whole country rising up, when we have the power of all the people rising up, defying and saying, no, I want my Constitution, we will have our Constitution back.
Norman, did you want to add something? I'd like to comment on this too, but I know we've got more questions.
Okay. Briefly, I think a key aspect is infrastructure. You know, when we go around the country, we talk to people who are doing a tremendous amount with something less than the Pentagon Martini budget for one afternoon. And that's a reality that, you know, we just don't have infrastructure funded. It's bad enough for electoral work. How about other sorts of work? It's even worse in general. And so it's very difficult to get much momentum that way.
I will say, oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
No, you go, and then I'll gather my thoughts.
I just wanted to add a quick comment, and we need to get back to questions too. But you know, the idea of de-emphasizing the elections, I think, is supported by a couple of major factors right now. One is that the elections tend to be stolen, right? So, you know, I mean, it's not, Kerry did lose in the sense that he didn't end up in the White House. He didn't lose in the traditional sense. They didn't turn out the voters. And so that's, I think, a discouraging factor. It's also arguably a reasonable factor for a case for de-emphasizing elections. The other, of course, is that we're likely to be, as a peace movement, facing a choice between a candidate who will continue the occupation and a candidate who will continue the occupation. And, you know, it's not true that all of the Democrats refused to commit to getting out by 2013. 5 out of the 8 would get us out by 2013, and 4 of them in a reasonably sane and sensible way. And so it's debatable whether we have to limit ourselves to the 3 worst candidates and then reject all 8 because the 3 that we limited ourselves to are so bad. But assuming that we do, we're going to have an election between a pro-war candidate and a pro-war candidate. So imagine if people realized that. We have no candidate to vote for and no confidence that our vote will be counted. What if we put all of that money and all of those resources and all of that creativity and all of that energy into what happens in between elections, into what the Constitution emphasized as the role of citizens in the government, which has nothing to do with elections, which, you know, at this moment, above all, calls for a demand for impeachment, which is a movement that has never had a dollar invested in it. You know, so there are different avenues, I think, we can go to. And what if some of that money and time and energy were put into organizations like Tina's, doing the work that needs to be done in this country, which has very little to do with elections, but in the end ends up giving you better outcomes from elections as a result.
And I'll just add one other little thing, which is that, yes, exactly. What if we did that? You know, we hear a lot about fear in this country and the climate of fear and how we're all afraid and that's why people aren't active. I think it's a bunch of baloney. I think people are skeptical that what they do will make any difference and that anybody will ever stand up for them. And I finally decided that for sure when I was this June, I think, in Atlanta for the U.S. Social Forum. The U.S. Social Forum was a gathering, was first U.S. gathering of a type of gatherings that have been happening all around the world for the last 7 years. And it's intended to bring civil society together, to permit civil society, organizations like yours, organizations like Tina's and Norman's and journalists like me, maybe, together to build power, build relationships, build power, to make another world possible. Their slogan at the U.S. Social Forum was, another world is possible, another U.S. is necessary. And to Atlanta came. This was an event that was organized 90% by people of color, 70% by women, 40% of the organizers were under 40 years old, grassroots organizations without even the afternoon martini budget of the Pentagon. And the funders, the big foundations, had not believed it was possible. And they hadn't put any money up until the last minute. And even at the last minute, they didn't put up very much. The organizations themselves had to bring their own people there. And they'd made the decision, well, rather than bring a few people by plane, we'll bring a lot of people by bus. And so we were all waiting morning of the first day of this conference, 3-day conference, to see how many people were going to show up. And down, I think it's called Peachtree Street, in the middle of Atlanta, started appearing people. And first a few people, and I was thinking, oh, that's not very impressive, maybe 500 or something. I thought, oh dear. And then I heard that the buses hadn't arrived yet. And gradually, as the hours went by, more people started showing up. And as the buses arrived, more people started showing up. And the weather was hot, and these people were coming from places where they had every reason to be afraid. Afraid of the Klan, afraid of the courts, afraid of the bailiff, afraid of the tax man, afraid of the police, afraid of people in their community. And yet they had gotten on buses and they had traveled across the country and by the end, with no money. And by the end, the Weston Peachtree Hotel, which is normally the hotel of the Southern Baptist Convention, was filled to capacity with poor people, filled to capacity with people with kids and dogs in their stuffing carrier bags. And they brought 15,000 people to Atlanta to meet and talk about, how do we protect public housing? What do we do when they come with their bulldozers to shut down public housing? What do we do? You had the people from New Orleans talking to the people from Miami, talking to the people from Oakland, talking to the people from Brooklyn. And none of them were talking about elections. None of them were talking about yet, not anyway, talking about running for office. They were all quite clear that nobody was going to save them but themselves and each other. And in that, I saw a lot of hope. It wasn't a demonstration in a sense, although the local housing authority in Atlanta that does have a big plan to flatten public housing was so scared that there would be a demonstration that they called a retreat for all of their workers and evacuated. It wasn't a demonstration in a typical sense, but it was an extraordinary event. And it got no coverage because it was poor people, people of color, women, and young people talking about stuff that at a level that we don't even talk about it, about what's really happening in this country. So I do think we have to allow the possibility that political activism might look different today than it did 40 years ago, and maybe we don't know how to recognize it yet.
More questions?
I don't know what scares me most. I started reading a little book that I got so scared I put it down. It's called Don't Think of an Elephant. And what you are saying, Laura, scares me almost as much as what that, because it sounds like you're saying the Democratic leadership is turning into Republicans in their approach to sort of controlling the messaging.
They're turning into incompetence.
And that's true, because the Republicans are competent in the way they their paternalistic approach to things. Do you think there's hope, though?
Yes, Blue Grit. It's all about hope. I say it's a good news book. It's not a feel good book, but it's a good news book.
And then a question that I don't know that there's ever really been an answer since Vietnam, and that is, you know, we're an awfully old crowd here. You know, how do we get our younger people involved? Not pejorative, please, but really, you know, who's here under the age of 50? Okay. It's an older crowd. Right. Got any words of wisdom for us?
Someone else.
Will the fact that the Democrats are turning into Republicans scare the hell out of them and bring them out of the woodwork?
You know, and that's, you know, I've crossed a lot of different lines and everything. I've sat on Democratic Central Committees. I've run congressional campaigns for the Democratic Party. A lot of things before I really got into being more of a peace activist and then into an organizer, which is mainly what I try to do now, is help organize any community that wants to do something to help change things. The youth is out there. The youth is out there. They're strong. They're vibrant. I work with the Hip Hop Caucus. I work with many different organizations, and they're there. They're just doing it differently. If you ask them to come to listen to a bunch of middle-aged people speak at a forum, they're not going to show up. Invite them, organize a hip hop event, and invite them out and start advertising grassroots with you know, get out into the communities, get out into the flyers, get out into the universities, and organize a hip-hop event with the theme of, like, Stop the Torture, what Reverend Yearwood does with the Hip-Hop Caucus, so many different things. And you see the youth there, and you see them organizing, and you see them involved. This march on September 15th, one of the biggest driving forces that we had Iraq Vets Against the War, and we had the youth contingent there that had so much energy, and they wanted to know, well, when's the next march? What else can I do? But there seems to be this other side when I go to other different events, and they're going, well, where's the youth? There's no youth out there. And these other events I go to, it's nothing but youth. So the youth is out there. It's just a matter of making that connection and devising events that is going to attract them, because they probably don't want to come to an event. I know my daughter, 13 right there, is probably bored out of her mind. She doesn't want to come to an event with a bunch of middle-aged people talking.
But don't they... I find, and I've got boys in my early 20s.
It'd be great for the recording if you could go near the microphone.
What I find in my nieces and nephews and my sons who are in their mid to late 20s is they just feel like it's not, you know, nothing they do can make a difference. They just don't feel like from the 60s, they don't feel that one person can make a difference because the machine is so big. But you're telling me that it can happen.
It can, and I see it, and I see it happening more and more, actually. And I see when I go and speak at the universities that the universities are starting to organize too. And the students there in the university, as the system is taking away the money from the schools and their tuitions, that you start forcing people almost into this, this, I'm so disempowered, I have no way to do anything, to, you know what, if I don't do something, I'm not going to have a life. And forcing them to actually take action, but making that connection and giving them tools. And that goes back to how you said, they said, oh, I don't know how, what I can do. Providing ways on how they can get involved that attracts them and getting them in on that level, you can see them get involved. When my daughter, when we do different events, there's some events she's highly involved in, and there's other events that she wishes she could just pull out all of her hair, like probably this one.
Hey!
But there's some events that she's highly empowered. But it's simply providing those. And I think it's our duty as the older generation and the generation of the 60s and 70s and the activism to provide those opportunities, to show them how they can help and to make it in a format that draws them in where they can see it. And that's what I try to do. I feel that responsibility that I need to do that.
Yeah, I just add that we all, young and not, live in a culture that is very reliant on psychic numbing, on encouraging passivity. The media and cultural dominance from that's driven by big money, mass corporate advertising and underwriting. And so that's a context. We're all in that context. The only message that mass media give consistently is to go out and buy things, and yeah, maybe vote once in a while in passing. And meanwhile, one generation never automatically transfers anything to the other unless we do it. And there's been a colossal failure of the generation that is called baby boom to convey the essence of maybe what we experienced at its best. So it's been left largely to the mass culture, and that's bound to be a disaster. And we, you know, we have the opportunity still to try to make that right.
I think I've talked enough, and my book both ends and begins with young people, and I think you'll find a lot answering your question in Blue Grit.
Part of the answer, obviously, is that our organizations that put together events like this don't make youth groups part of the organization of the event. We just expect them to show up. But there aren't any prominent youth groups around that it's obvious to reach out to, and there clearly seems to be less youth activism than there was a couple generations back. And I maybe you've already answered this, but I'd love to ask Norman's opinion, because when I watch or read War Made Easy, the overall theme seems to be it's all been exactly this bad for decades. They've told us the exact same lies over and over again, and yet I have this nagging suspicion that it's incredibly worse now, and that kids now have seen so much television. They've been instructed so heavily and so skillfully to sit down and do nothing that, you know, in your view, what if anything is fundamentally worse in the warfare state and in the media part of it from years ago, and as opposed to what is exactly the same and we just haven't learned decade after decade?
The impacts of militarization of the society and corporatization of consciousness, if you will, have been aggregate, I think. So there's been decade after decade where the media assault is multimedia, which is taken to be a positive. It's actually in many ways a negative. I mean, we dealt with three networks and Life magazine and Time and the newspapers and Top 40 radio. Okay, that was bad enough. Now it's a continuous assault. There's some positives. We've got the internet, but even the internet is mostly corporatized. I do have a problem often. We wax nostalgic about 30 or 40 years ago. Even at the height of the anti-war movement in this country 35, 40 years ago, most young people were uninvolved. Richard Nixon bragged in 72 he got a majority of the youth vote. At a time when McGovern was running, the only decent Democratic presidential nominee around war issues in my lifetime. So it's the same with media as well. We waxed nostalgic for good old days that never existed. Every Democratic presidential administration has been fundamentally based on deception about war and peace issues in the last 50 years. And we could just walk through, and I won't take the time. Every single administration and every Democratic Party establishment has been part of a suppressive infrastructure that didn't welcome much Democratic participation. So we, I think it's a dualistic, I'm departing a little bit, but I just close by saying, I think it's important when a Jim Webb replaces an Allen. That's important. And at the same time, that just indicates that it's possible from the grassroots to make change. And then the next step is to put other people in office who are going to be even better than he is.
And I do have to say something. David, you made me crazy. Think of the biggest movements we've had in the last 15 years, the movements against sweatshops, the movements against globalized trade, the movements for financing of research for AIDS. The youth have been the forefront of all of those movements. Today, they are the forefront of the movement against recruiting, because it's them who's being recruited. And I think that one of the structural, because again, it's usually not just an attitudinal problem, there's a structural problem. One of the structural problems is that baby boomers who started nonprofit organizations 30 years ago still head up those same nonprofit organizations. And it's been a real problem, particularly in the South, that to dislodge that generation of the good old days, because there are literally no jobs for young people to move into, because people like Norman and I still have them. I think that it's really true. I mean, as I said, in Blue Grit, you'll find a lot of the answers to what are young people doing and how are they doing it differently. But I think that we also need to do some things differently. I don't think it's that they are, quote, they are not active. I think they're in a very difficult situation, much more difficult than 40 years ago, not just because the culture has been battering their heads in more through more media outlets than before, but because there's less school aid. In concrete terms, there's less school aid. They're more in debt when they get out of college. There's less housing available. They have to spend more money on basic expenses. They can't work for free in the way that so many of us did for so long. Maybe they could, but they don't believe they could. And the credit card companies that come to them before they've even arrived at college make sure that they believe they can't because they're scared to death. So, you know, I just had to stand up for the youth.
Thank you. Next question.
I know this meeting is dedicated to ending the war in Iraq. That's the current war. I'd like to ask a question about the relationship between a globe of increasing scarcities, water, arable land, oil, etc., and the thinking of the rulers of our nation and other nations, and the relationship between global warming and future violence and war. And, of course, the one good thing could happen when they announce the Nobel Prize winner for peace this year, it could be Al Gore. And that could make a big difference, I hope, in America. But I suspect that the military likes to motivate our thinking with fear, and that there are plenty of things to fear in the future with global warming. And whether this couldn't have some effect on future violence and future wars.
I'm just going to recommend a book, not mine, but Naomi Klein's new book, Shock Doctrine, which pulls all those things together really, really well, and maybe you'll think of bringing her here to talk, because I think she says it better than I possibly could about the interrelationship of the two.
And Lester Brown's Plan B is an excellent one, too.
More questions?
And we are going to be signing books at the back.
We may need to make this the last question because people are going to want to get books signed. And
then I think I might have a really good question to end this with.
Beautiful.
I admit I didn't pay much attention to politics until September 11th, and I was glued to the television and I have been ever since. And I recognize all the politicians by their face. I know who they are now, and I'm not too impressed anyway. But what I want to know is, and after seeing your movie last week, and now it's sinking in that what I'm watching on TV isn't really telling me anything. They're just telling me what the White House wants us to hear. And there's so many books coming out. I can't afford to buy them all, and I wonder, does anybody know if the local libraries carry these books?
It just takes one of you to buy one. You can give it to a library.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sure. Or aside from the internet and searching and trying to get the truth, I mean, what do you do?
Support your independent bookstores. Do buy these books and do share them, and urge your libraries to order them. Often when people say, and it's definitely true, there isn't time to get even a huge fraction or a significant fraction of what we would like to every day. I could suggest 100 websites and techniques, but let me just give one of them and you may come up with your own formula. Let's say you have an hour a day. I'd recommend read the Washington Post or the New York Times and go to commondreams.org and do it each day. Read one daily paper that's considered exhaustive, U.S. paper, and then read 15 of the articles on Common Dreams that are posted each day. And you'll sometimes wonder if you're living on the same planet when you read both of them. Another example would be listen to All Things Considered or Morning Edition, and then listen to or watch Democracy Now. Again, you'll wonder, what are they doing at NPR? Are they on planet Earth? What does it have to do with what Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez and Jeremy Scahill and others are reporting? And just that combination, I think, confronts us with the way that one world can be reported in such different ways and viewed in such different worlds and ways. And then we can, pardon the expression, develop a more dialectical analysis of how these propaganda lines intersect with the real world. And I would just close by saying, without being flip, because I don't mean to conflate each president or each mass media outlet, on the major issues of the day, they're always wrong. They are always wrong. But the question is the degree to which they're wrong. And when you subject to scrutiny, as I have in terms of war, the New York Times and the Washington Post and the LA Times, and you go in the microfilm and Nexus, and you look at how they reported 1960, 70, 80, 90, 2000, and the present day, we're getting a distorted view, and it's up to us to understand it, deconstruct it, and do something about it.
And you do have an opportunity to build new radio stations in this community, as I understand it. And you even have an opportunity tonight to pledge to send a message to the FCC that you will support such a radio station. I really think none of us has a right to complain about the media unless we are actively maintaining some of our own. So you have that opportunity this evening, right? Isn't that true? There are pledge forms outside in the back.
Raise your hand, Ken.
There's an opening for new licenses to be granted, applied for and granted, coming up in later October, right now, actually, starting a week from next week. And this is an opportunity we haven't had in 25 years. So be part of it. All right, we're going to be signing books at the back. Thank you so much, everybody.
Thank you, everyone, for coming.